Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In a new cookbook called Bress and Yam, Gullah Geechee recipes from a sixth-generation farmer, chef and farmer Matthew Rayford, who, by the way, calls himself a sha-farmer, shares the recipes and traditions inherited across seven generations, rooted in his family's farm in coastal Georgia. About 10 years ago, Matthew Rayford and his sister inherited the family farm, which was purchased by their great-great-great-grandfather, Jupiter Gilliard, in 1874. Throughout the book, he traces a history of community and family through the lens of food. Bress and Yam means bless and eat in the Gullah language, and it's a powerful title for this cookbook. As Rayford writes in the introduction, quote, "A cookbook can serve simply as a compendium of recipes, or it can offer a story of a people and a place. I am the prodigal son, the custodian of Jupiter Gilliard's legacy. This book is my origin story." Bress and Yam is co-authored with Amy Page Condon, and I'm so happy that Chef Matthew Rayford joins us now. Welcome to All of It.
Thank you.
So nice to have you here. I'm wondering
Would
you mind reading the beginning of your introduction to the book titled Prodigal Son? It's really beautiful, and it totally sets the scene. It's on page 11.
Thank you. Yes. Yes, I'm there. There are days when I am standing in the fresh dirt just after the turmeric and ginger have gone into the ground and the chickens are making all kinds of fuss. And I just laugh that I'm back here with a hoe in my hand. It's hardly picture perfect. I'm not wearing a coiffed beard and Carhartt overalls surrounded by symmetrical rows of ruffled lettuces. There's a chicken coop to build as hurricane season fast approaches. A few years ago, we learned never again to think if, but when, with three storms hitting within a 12-month period that destroyed our hoop houses, beehives, and uprooted every crop. The compost heap needs attention, and it still does, and the grass needs to be mowed because of the unrelenting rain, and there are so many seeds to plant, and it is so hot. I knew it would be hard coming back, not just the farming, but also as a black man in the South who cooks in the kitchen and works the land. That's a lot of past to reckon with. More than 30 years ago, at the age of 18, I stood right here on this land and told my Nana, I'm never coming back. She looked me dead in the face and said, baby, you never know when you'll need to come home. She was right. Nana was always right.
You begin with the story of your great-great-great-grandfather, Jupiter Gilliard. Tell us a little about who he was, and how did he come to own what is now Gilliard Farms?
So he was born a slave in 1812 in South Carolina. And during the Reconstruction era, very shortly after the after emancipation, Jupiter was able to purchase for $9 in taxes 450 acres of land 15 miles west of Brunswick. And how you'd have to think about it is this. Brunswick is kind of like a peninsula. We have Jekyll Island and St. Simon's Island, lots of waterways. So we're not thinking about the Eisenhower interstate system that we're talking about right now with all the bridges and things like that. Right. We're talking like ferries is like the only way you get from one place to the other. And you also have to think about the fact that there weren't a lot of powered things that could move you to and from. So there weren't a lot of people in the area that weren't black at that particular time because of white flight right after the Civil War. And so Jupiter, my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, had to swear allegiance to the Union and basically pay for the land.
Now, you write that the farm was my sanctuary as a kid. How so?
Well, you know, so I grew up in Brunswick proper, right, inside the city of Brunswick. It's a very small micro city of Brunswick. And it was, you know, growing up in Brunswick at the particular time, we're talking like the 70s, I was one of the kids that you could consider to be a gifted child, I guess. Mm-hmm. So by the time I got to the first grade, I already knew how to read, write, add, and subtract. So there wasn't a lot for me to have to do because I come from a very education-driven family. Mm-hmm. So first through fifth grade, there wasn't that much. And so, you know, I would get teachers that would say things like, how do you know that? That's not right. You know, and I would challenge it, and they'd be like, ain't no black boy supposed to know that. Those kinds of things. So The farm ended up being one of those places that I would go to, and, you know, my great-grandmother Florine would be there. I'd sit on the porch and, you know, clip off field peas with her. My great-uncle Horace would take us out into the fields and show us how to plant watermelon and all those kinds of things. And then, I mean, I had the most abundant amount of nature you could possibly imagine as a child. And I guess it was that actually drew me back, is the beauty of nature.
Those are some lovely memories you have. That's it's just so nice to hear. You knew at a young age, you knew at a young age that you wanted to be a chef, but that didn't happen. How come?
Well, my dad was a baker by trade from the 50s and 60s, and he was raised in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So I was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So when we moved down here, he wasn't able to get a job because my dad didn't learn how to read or write until he was 25.
Oh, wow.
So he basically had to memorize everything. Like, if he saw you use a cup, he'd know that that's the amount, you know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he grew up in a time period where he didn't know of any black chefs, nevertheless bakers, pastry chefs that had or owned their own places. So my dad was like, when I told him I wanted to do that, he was like, boy, there's a lot of things you can be, and cooking ain't one of them. So he didn't want me to be in kind of a servitude mode, because that is
right
what it was always seen like before. And, you know, cooking as a whole didn't really become a profession until the late 70s, early 80s here in the United States, whereas in Europe it was already considered to be that. So I showed my dad. I went in the military.
Okay.
I didn't.
I was just going to ask, what did you do instead?
I went in the military. I didn't do anything that resembled cooking at all while I was in the military. And it's so funny because, you know, when I remember getting to Germany the very first time, and somebody asking me where I was from, and I was like, oh, I'm from Georgia. And they were like, dude, do you know how to make biscuits? Can you make collard greens? Like, we haven't had good food around here in a long time. I was just looking at them like, that's what you think of people from Georgia? That's what we, you know. But it was kind of funny because I ended up always being like the barbecue guy, always the guy that was like, oh, y'all need some potato salad? Oh, I can make potato salad for you on a hot plate, you know.
Right.
Just loving food as a whole. And then growing up from the earth. So everything, you know, one of my first jobs was at a Piggly Wiggly, grocery store. Yes, that is a thing, y'all. A Piggly Wiggly grocery store.
and we have Wawa's.
I worked in a deli bakery. Yeah. And it's funny because I never saw people buy everything from the grocery store. Like, I saw people go to the grocery store and go shopping, and I bag groceries all the time. Was mostly stuff like canned goods, right? I didn't see people go to the grocery store to buy a lot of produce kind of stuff, because everybody I knew grew stuff. I mean, it didn't matter what color you were. Somebody had cucumbers, somebody else had tomatoes, somebody had peas, somebody had sweet potatoes, somebody had red potatoes. And so people were always swapping stuff out. Like, I got too much of this. Here, you can have, you know, and everybody canned and, you know, did, you know, food preservation. So I kind of got to grew up with those kinds of, like, thoughts, you know, and being around food like that. So because I was around food like that, I just wanted to cook, you know, and that kind of didn't happen at the beginning. But then, you know, I got out of the military. I was going to Howard University to be a physical therapist, and I was doing what any 28-year-old freshman would be doing, or at least I thought, which was throwing parties and cooking. And people would always go, where did you learn how to cook like this? And I was like, I just know how to cook. And right. then that turned into me going to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York.
That was another thing I was going to ask, like, what was it, sort of a natural progression? It's like, I've just been doing this all along. I may as well learn how to do it professionally. Or was there,
you know,
was there, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was going to say, it's funny because what happened was in 1995, physical therapy, it changed that you needed to have a master's degree to practice physical therapy. And because I was in school for physical therapy, I was sitting in class one day and I was like, how many years of school is that? And they was like, anywhere from 6 to 7 years. And I was like, so I'm 28. I'll be 35 before I can ever get a job.
Yeah.
No, that doesn't make any sense. Right. And so in my head, I was like, and I ended up talking to some older students that were there that were like in the PA program and the psychology program and other doctoral programs. And they were like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I really want to just cook. And they were like, why don't you go to school to learn how to cook? And I was like, I already know how to cook, one. And two, I don't know nobody black that's making close to six figures. Like, I just didn't know of anybody, you know,
right.
or had ever even heard of anybody. So I was just like, I don't think culinary is the way for me to go. And next thing you know, I meet Chef Earlis Bell. In Washington, D.C. He was over the J.W. Marriott at the time. And then after that, I ended up meeting Chef Joe Randall, who did the African Heritage Dinner. So I started meeting all these black chefs that were like, had been in the industry for like 20, 30 years. And I was like, oh, my God. So not only are we here, but we're also making money, you know? And so that kind of, you know, I mean, think about it. Like in the 90s, everybody was like, okay, you got to go to school. You got to get a degree. Here are all the things you need to do. And then, you know, and I was like, I don't know what I need to do. But, yeah, I originally ended up at a small one, like nine-month program in Falls Church, Virginia called ATI. My chef at the time was Chef David Ivy Soto, who was a graduate from CIA and was like, look, dude, you need to go and get a degree in this. There's some more stuff. Like, this isn't going to be good enough for you. We already know it. And then next thing you know, I was at CIA, and the rest is history so far as culinary goes.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Chef Matthew Rayford about his cookbook, Bressin Yam, Gullah Geechee Recipes from a Sixth-Generation Farmer. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll resume our conversation. This is All of It. Stay with us. It's All of It on WNYC. I'm Carrie Nolan in for Allison Stewart, and I'm speaking with Chef Matthew Rayford about his amazing cookbook, Bressin Yam, Gullah Geechee Recipes from a Sixth-Generation Farmer. We've gotten a little bit of history about how you came to become a chef after having been raised in a micro city, as you call it, and on your family farm. Now, in the book, you share this really powerful moment when you returned to the farm and your Nana handed you and your sister the deed to the remaining 28 acres of land. What happened during that conversation, and what were you thinking about at that moment?
I think the ancestors just welled up in me and was like, boy, this is what you need to do. That's what I kind of feel like, because I also feel like I kind of got, my sister and I kind of got ambushed. So for years, I have been telling every time they would call a family meeting or something, I'd be like, hey, y'all should go back to farming because that's what y'all know how to do. That's what I've always said. And for some reason, at this particular time, my Nana asked for my sister and I both to make sure we were at this family reunion. Mm-hmm. And so we both came down, and at the time I was married, and brought my wife and my small son down, and you know, it's family, right? So everybody sees family. Everybody's loving on everybody and everything. And my mom goes, hey, mama wants to talk to y'all. Come on over here. So Althea and I walk away, and, you know, we go sit down at a table. And my mom, my Aunt Mary Lou, and my Nana were all sitting at a table. And my Nana just goes, baby, what are we going to do with all this land? And I just, like, my eyes kind of got big, and I looked over at my sister and kind of nodded a little bit, and I turned back around, and I swear to you, it felt like somebody came and said, just whispered in my ear, Matthew, y'all need to take the land and farm it. That's what it felt like, because I said those exact words to my Nana. Nana, we going to go back to farming it. And she said, baby, did you say we? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, really? And she reaches underneath the table and gives these, my sister and I, that first set of land, and then says, baby, I guess y'all better get the farming, and got it from the table.
Like, I just got chills at that story.
Yeah, it was, and it's really interesting because my sister and I tell the story the exact same way, and my sister says she felt like almost like an out of body experience as it was happening. Like she felt like she was looking back at herself, going, yeah, go ahead. That's what you're supposed to be doing. You know, that kind of a thing. And, you know, now I ended up going to UC Santa Cruz to the Center for Agroecology and Sustainable Food Systems, getting a graduate certificate in ecological horticulture from them. And then I came back home, mid-2011, and I've been back home ever since.
Let's put, as much as I'm fascinated by all of this, let's put the history aside for a moment and talk about the recipes, the reason that you farm.
Yes.
Let's talk about Gullah Geechee cooking. What are the regions mm-hmm. we're talking to? Who are the people that live there? How did this cuisine develop?
Yes, so the Gullah Geechee corridor runs from North Carolina to North Florida. And all of those barrier islands and that coastal land that rolls across there are folks that are descendants from West Africans that were abandoned and left on the island and on the coast to fend for themselves after the war. And they were thought to have probably die off because they didn't have any, like, well, they didn't think that they had any, like, skills or anything to be able to survive without there being a slave master there. And mm-hmm. so what happened was is that I guess they totally forgot about the fact that these are folks that were farmers, they were fishermen, they were hunters. Like, they were doing all of those things on the island and on the coast all this other time. I don't know why they thought that when people left that they wouldn't be able to continue to do it. And so basically, Gullah Geechee cuisine at its most primal would be eating from the land, eating okay. only what you have and seasonally. And I remember not eating tomatoes anytime out of April and like October. Like if it wasn't April and October, I wasn't eating any tomatoes. We didn't have any.
Right.
You know? Right. And a lot of times people go, October? I'm like, yeah, it's hot here. Like it gets well into the 70s. By late March, early April, and doesn't even start slowing down out of the 70s and 80s until almost November.
Wow.
So we have a 10-month growing season here on the coast. So that also means that that we're growing sugarcane and making molasses. We're hunting and fishing according to the seasons. We're eating oysters all the months with the R in it, right? We're eating shrimp all through shrimp season. So that's why I said at its core, it's eating from the earth from the time period that the food would normally come in, because that's all we had.
Right, exactly.
And then it's also the thought process that it's also not a monolith food. So each area had things that were growing and doing differently. So a lot of times I hear people go, oh, do you make shrimp and grits? And I go, no, that's a Charlestonian thing. People are like, wait, what? And I said, down here where I live, it would literally be fish and grits with okra and stewed tomatoes, like a piece of fried fish. Mm-hmm. And they were like, wait, what? And I said, yeah. I said, because in the different regions, people don't necessarily eat all of the exact same thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, they do, but they don't. For instance,
sure.
Purlieu in South Carolina my mom called it a shrimp Creole. But the reason she called it a shrimp Creole was because one of her girlfriends was from Louisiana, and that's how she learned to make it the way she makes it. So I always called it, and it's in the book, Effie Shrimp Creole. But it's basically a purlieu. That's basically what it is. And if you were to get into an even more historical context, right, if you think about a purlieu and think about a paella, they're very close in how they're put together and the ingredients that go in them.
Now, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say the Spaniards at one point in time just traveled up and down the coast from the Carolinas into Florida because, you know, for a long time they owned Florida. So there's a lot of that that also falls into cooking and eating and all those kinds of things is the mashup of all the people that ended up in these areas.
Now, you talk about shrimp Creole and purlieu and paella, and there is a section in the book about rice as the foundation of Tidewater communities and that low country coastal cooking. Let's talk a little bit about your recipe for gullah rice. And we have that, by the way, on our website at allofit.org.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So,
what would you like to talk about?
Well, all of it, as we like to say. How does this dish come together? Talk about some of the flavors that stand out in it.
So the flavors that truly stand out in it, that sit at the top of my mind, are the fact that, you know, you take this dish and you are sautéing off very slowly, like garlic and paprika and salt and pepper and crushed tomatoes, and then adding that rice and that stock in, and it becomes almost like, for me, it's like, how would I say it? Some people call it red rice. Mm-hmm. It's a tomato-based rice, right? And what's really funny is because all the vegetables are in there, because when you don't have meat, you still need to have other things to keep you going. It's kind of like a dinner dish that sticks to your ribs. You know how they talk about grit sticks to your ribs, cream sticks to your ribs? This is kind of like a dinner dish that sticks to your ribs.
So
and it's
is
also
this,
like comfort food.
Then what I was going to suggest is that, is it almost like a rice stew in terms of its, you know, it's being not soupy,
yes.
But okay.
Yes.
So almost it's not like a dry rice.
It's not a dry rice at all. I mean, you have those tomatoes, those peppers, that garlic, the onion, it's all in there. And then you have the habanero peppers that are in there to give it a little bit of spice.
Oh,
also.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, let me tell you a quick little interesting fact.
Sure.
Do you know why people eat hot peppers, the original reason why people eat hot peppers?
I've always thought it was because it caused you to sweat, which cooled you down in hot climates.
Boom. You got it. You know how many times I hear people like, oh, they can eat hot peppers. I can't really eat hot peppers. I said, well, where are you from?
Like
being where you're from allows you to tolerate heat differently when it comes to food. And so, yes, those things were eaten that way. You're awesome. I'm so glad you're interviewing me today.
So am I. You include a recipe for making your own vegetable stock. Now, I got to tell you, I have never found a recipe that I like yet. So I'm going to have to try yours. Why do why is it better in your mind to make your own versus going to the grocery store?
So for me, it's all about controlling what goes in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's about. So I can control the salt, I can control what vegetables I put in, I can control how much I put in of each vegetable, what flavor I want to sit at the very, very, very top, as compared to what I want it to sit at the very, very, very bottom. So I like, and you know, I mean, think about it. So many people, especially since C-19 has come through, have done their own gardening. They're growing like small herb boxes with things like rosemary, thyme, and oregano. It's great. Put things in the stock that you like. Make it for you. And then you jar it or put it in ice cube trays or whatever according to how you use it or how you would use it, which would be, you know, if you're going to use the vegetable stock for rice, at a bare minimum, you need 2 cups of it, you know?
Right.
So
exactly.
It's kind of like things like that. Yeah. And so it allows you also to not have a lot of waste, right? It's not just sitting in the refrigerator waiting to go bad or sitting on a shelf with an expiration date. Basically, you can freeze this for quite some time. Like, I mean, I've frozen it for up to 6 to 8 months and just pulled it out as I needed it.
That sounds about right.
But I don't think I've ever had vegetable stock last that long either.
I can't wait to make yours. I also, in the few minutes that we have left, I want to talk about, it's a really super simple thing, but you don't see them in this area, in the New York area, very much, at least not really good ones. Hot buttermilk biscuits with honey butter. Clearly, I haven't had lunch yet. So talk to me about this.
So what I love about these biscuits is there's really only 3, maybe 4 ingredients in it if you count the cracked black pepper. Mm-hmm. So it's self-rising flour, okay? It's heavy cream, which usually has 40% milk fat in it.
Right.
So you don't need butter. So you don't need to add butter. You already got the milk fat.
Yep.
Already got it. Right. And so when you're folding all that in, you get it to where it's nice and tacky, that where a little bit sticks on your finger, not the whole thing sticks on your finger kind of a thing. That's about the way you want it. You dust off your area, you roll it out to the thickness that you want, and put it in the oven. Like it's, and then honey butter. I mean, I can't say enough about honey butter. Like, we have our own beehives too, so we're still, in a couple of months, we'll be pulling some honey from them, and ours is a really dark honey that we get from them. It's amazing.
Oh,
it's amazing.
Gosh.
But you just let some butter just get to room temperature and then add some honey. I believe the recipe's in here also. And then you just whip it together, and that too, you just put it back in the refrigerator, and then, you know, whether you're doing biscuits or cornbread or even your regular everyday toast, that's what you want to do. And you know what? This recipe is very unforgiving. Because with, you know, like, I put cracked black pepper in it just to give that little, what's that? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Not for, like, the massive heat or anything. I just like the amazing look I get on people's face when they realize that there's a piece of pepper, some honey, there's some butter, there's this big fat biscuit that they're eating. They're like, I would have never thought. And I said, I know. Just enjoy it.
I know there is a recipe that I've used for blueberry pie that uses black pepper in it. And that's,
yes,
that's very surprising when, you know, people who aren't expecting it see it.
Right.
So black pepper is sort of a secret weapon in a lot of ways.
Secret. Very much so. Very much so.
Now, we can't forget dessert, even though we've had honey butter. You write that you still make Nana's sweet potato pie every chance you get. So in the few minutes we have left, tell us the story behind this recipe.
So my Nana is hilarious. So my Nana always made these sweet potato pies. Like, she was known, like, you know, the there's always somebody at your local congregation that makes the best thing ever, and everybody calls on that person to make them. My Nana's sweet potato pie was always amazing, and it always had this little kind of like glassy top to it all the time. And I could never figure out, like, I don't get what, like, how does she, I mean, I've tried sugar, I tried all kind of stuff, right? Try to make my own glaze. And I was like, why doesn't it come out like hers? And basically what happens is the top of the pie gets like this glassy feel to it. It gets kind of a hard, almost like a burnt sugar feel. Mm-hmm. And then everything underneath it is super moist. So when you bite into it, it's like this crunch and then like the sweetness, you know, that feeling of euphoria just flows over your whole body all of a sudden. And so I wanted to learn how to make it. And I actually sat with my Nana for quite some time making sweet potato pies with her, trying to perfect this thing. And every time she'd be like, mm-mm, see, you done whipped it too long. Mm-mm, you haven't whipped it long enough. Mm-mm, you put the butter in too soon. Mm-mm. It was never like, you got it, right? And I have a video, a very short clip video, where I show her telling me what I was doing wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And then showing me how to do it. And then, literally, I tell you no lie, The day I finally got it right, she says to me, "So now what you gonna teach me how to cook?" I was like, "What the heck? I don't know what to teach you. Like, you taught me the most amazing thing ever, and now you want me to teach you something how to cook? I don't think I can do that just yet."
That's just another way of handing you the deed. Matthew Rayford is the author, along with Amy Page Condon, of Bresson Yam Gullah Geechee Recipes from a Sixth-Generation Farmer. I have not had so much fun talking to someone in a very long time, and I'm so glad you joined us today on All of It. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. This is a pleasure.